Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today. Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Tuesday afternoon, October the 26th. We continue our series on apparent contradictions in the Bible with the varying, or some would say, varied accounts of the resurrection of Christ. And if you sit down with the four Gospels and you read them one after another, usually the last chapters there, that deal with the resurrection accounts, you will almost immediately begin to know some differences, big and small, and some have even raised the question of whether or not we're really dealing with one account or whether we're dealing with, some extrapolations. There seem to be some pretty glaring differences between them. Can they be resolved? Our call in number 1-877-623-MYIE. Dr. Jeff Kloa will be with us for the next 40 minutes of the program. You can email us, talkback@issuesetc.org, or you can leave questions or comments on these apparent contradictions with regard to the resurrection accounts at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Jeff Kloa is Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Dr. Kloa, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Great.
Why do you think it is that of all the apparent contradictions in Scripture, these usually get the most attention, especially by Scripture's critics?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think the reason is that the resurrection is, quite obviously essential to the gospel. If you have no resurrection of Jesus bodily from the dead, then you have nothing of the Christian faith. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ has not been raised, you are still in your sins, your faith is futile, there's nothing. So the natural place to go to point out discrepancies and problems and ultimately to the argument goes to disprove something, you're going to want to disprove the resurrection because that is the central event of the Bible.
And with that said, the apparent discrepancies in the accounts begin almost immediately with the resurrection account. The first question that's often raised if people are reading the Gospels side by side is essentially which women and how many women total went to the tomb. There seem to be at least two, if not three, different versions of who was there or who wasn't there. How do we resolve this question of women at the tomb?
Right. I mean, if I could maybe take a step back to the first part of your statement there, Todd, you said if you read these side by side, and I guess I would suggest that reading them side by side is not the way that they were intended to be read. That is, Matthew wrote his gospel with his proclamation of the good news of Jesus. Mark wrote his gospel. Luke wrote his gospel. John wrote his gospel, apparently without awareness or really reference to one another. Now, we can talk about that to some extent. But by putting them side by side and trying to read what sort of happened as an extrapolation from those four, in other words, we're asking questions that the text isn't really trying to answer. And so I think part of the issue is maybe we should read Matthew and then read Mark and then read Luke and then read John and answer those questions. But fair enough, this has been an issue from the second century, since opponents of Christianity have pointed out discrepancies and problems. So it's not a new problem, but I think we need to keep that in mind, that maybe we should start with what the Gospels individually are trying to do.
Okay, all agree that Mary Magdalene's there, but from that point on, they don't seem to agree.
Yeah, they get different names. Right, and various explanations have been offered. Dr. Arendt suggested that you'll have certain people mentioned who are more prominent or more significant characters. I think the most the simplest one to deal with is Mary Magdalene. She's obviously mentioned in all four. John mentions only her, and without the other women. And I think that reflects what John is doing elsewhere in his gospel, where he tends to focus on individual characters. So you have, you know, Nicodemus individually approaching Jesus, or the beloved disciple as a individual character. And so it's really not surprising that John tends to move his narrative in the direction of individual characters interacting with Jesus. That's entirely in keeping with how he describes the story the rest of the way. With the synoptic gospels, and maybe I should define that term synoptic, meaning they have the same appearance, or they have the same eye on events, you might say. And there's a great deal of similarity among Matthew, Mark, and Luke throughout the gospels, not only in the resurrection accounts. And here, you know, there's a couple ways you can deal with it. There are a couple of Marys mentioned in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Mary Magdalene, and then another Mary. She's mentioned as mother of James in, I guess it's Mark and Luke. Matthew only calls her a Mary. You have others mentioned in Luke, and then just the generic others. And then Mark mentions a Salome. I think the easiest way to resolve that is the evangelists are only mentioning certain people. Some are more prominent than others. I think a good explanation is that, you know, Mark and Matthew and Luke are each writing for actual people, actual audiences, people who are going to read these texts. And perhaps they're mentioning names of people that these churches would already know. So perhaps the people that Mark was writing for knows Salome or a relative of Salome of some way, and so he mentions her specifically. Matthew doesn't feel the need to mention those. You know, I think there's various ways to account for the differences in a list of names quite easily.
So then what we're really talking about, at least with respect to the female witnesses at the tomb, we're talking about a handful of women, including mm-hmm. all of the women named, most certainly, maybe even more. We don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Luke mentions others, so.
Okay. Right. But most certainly Mary Magdalene, and then the other accounts dealing with Mary Magdalene in particular right. at the tomb are, in a sense, kind of a her close-up, so to speak, if we speak in cinematic terms.
Right. Right, that John chooses to focus is there. Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to say it. A close-up soliloquy almost, you know, bring it to front stage. Right.
Another, I consider this a minor apparent discrepancy in the account that some have pointed out is when the women actually went to the tomb. In particular, John says that it is in the dark, I think, and Mark at the other end.
Yeah, it was still dark, right?
Yeah, Mark seems to say the sun had already risen. What do you make of it?
Yeah, well, Mark's vocabulary is actually pretty dense in Greek. He throws a couple adjectives out, and exceedingly early on the first day of the week, after the rising of the sun, and it's a genitive absolute there, so is there a time reference? I guess my point is Mark, throughout his narrative, isn't real precise on chronological things anyway. You can, in fact, if you read Mark beginning to end, it sounds like Jesus' entire ministry takes about, you know, 2 months. I mean, he's very quickly going place to place. So you get the sense in Mark, and it's almost like stage setting. You know, you got to kind of roll the smoke and the dim light. And he seems to be describing that time of day when, you know, you start to have light, but it's very early. The sun has obviously risen. It's not night anymore, but is it really morning? You know, I mean, if you've ever woken up early and seen that, that's kind of the sense he's describing. It's not really as precise as I think people want it to be, and especially to contrast it with John. You know, early while it's still dark. Well, that's early in the day, which implies that the day has begun, but still dark, so it's not really full daylight yet. So I think both give a sense of, you know, it's kind of that it's still black and white. You're not seeing color yet. You're not seeing the you know, I'm really not real sympathetic with an argument that these are very different in their descriptions of the time that they're going out to the tomb.
And suffice it to say, we're not dealing in either case with authors who are whose primary concern is describing kind of the meteorological conditions
exactly.
of the day.
Yeah, well, and keep in mind, in the first century, you don't have clocks. You know, they don't have watches. They don't conceive of time the way we do in segmented, you know, 60 seconds, 60 minute hours. You know, we have a very different conception of time and progress and increments of time than you would have had in the first century. So, I think we're pressing them more than they're trying to do.
Another, you could begin a response to this with about a minute before our break. another discrepancy that some have believed to have found in the account is the number of angels and to whom they speak. How, with about a minute, would you outline the problem that the various texts present?
Well, it's the problem is you have one angel, and we'll just use that word for now, and let me just make sure I say this right. Matthew has one, and is it Luke has one? I made my list up. Mark definitely has one. No, Luke has two.
Yeah, Luke,
there we go.
Luke has two.
Luke has two, and John has two. And Mark and Matthew have one, right. And, I mean, it needs to be said, they're actually described differently, and some are angels and some are men, young men. I think the easiest explanation is simply that you will highlight the one who speaks. So you probably have two there, but one speaks, and why mention the other if he's not prominent? You know, one angel spoke in Matthew, and that's the one that you mentioned. In Mark, similarly, you have one speaking, and so an angel spoke to them. You know, so again, it's you're highlighting a specific feature, and you're not giving a photographic description of the event, I think is the simplest way to deal with that.
Dr. Jeff Kloa is our guest. He's Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. We're continuing our series on this Tuesday afternoon, October the 26th, on apparent contradictions in the Bible. Today, the resurrection account of Jesus Christ. I invite your questions or comments for Dr. Kloa, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can send us an email here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet @issuesetc, or visit our Facebook fan page and leave a question or comment for Dr. Kloa right there. We've given you some space to do so. Facebook.com/issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc.
The sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
Do Lutherans just follow the teachings of Martin Luther? How is Lutheranism similar and different from historic churches like Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is Lutheranism 101. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Lutheranism 101 by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Is it possible to be evangelical and Catholic? Lutheranism 101.
Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Monumental pro-life legislation in Oklahoma.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Of all the states passing pro-life legislation in response to national health care reform, no state has experienced more political turmoil than Oklahoma. After the state legislature passed two pro-life bills, the governor vetoed the legislation. However, both the House and Senate went through the extraordinary steps of overriding the veto. As a result, Oklahoma law now protects doctors who don't inform parents of their unborn baby's birth defects. The second law requires women considering abortion to be shown ultrasound images of their unborn child and to have the child's features described to her.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is a great little brand new volume called Lutheranism 101. It is what it sounds like, a primer, if you will, very engagingly put together and written from Concordia Publishing House on the mainstream of the 16th century Reformation, the Lutheran Confession. Lutheranism 101 is accessible to people of all ages. I imagine if you have a teenager, they will understand it as well as you do, and vice versa, depending on your mental capacity. Great resource for teaching, for personal study, you name it. Lutheranism 101. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order Lutheranism 101. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for Lutheranism 101. Dr. Kloa, here's one that is a bit more of a stumper, and it kind of requires us to, if you will, kind of timeline the events, especially after the women have come to the empty tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, when did Jesus actually appear to the women? There seems to be several appearances at work here.
Right.
Talk about that, if you would.
You mean when did Jesus appear, or when did the angels appear?
When did Jesus appear to the women? Some say to Mary Magdalene, then some whether women were leaving or when they came back.
Right. Well, the biggest difference again is going to be with John and the synoptic gospels. So with John, Jesus appears to Mary, sort of after they go back and report, and she's wandering back, and it's a gardener and. And then she's standing there, so it's right at the empty tomb. For Luke, there's no appearance until you get to the Emmaus incident, and then with Matthew, you have the women after they've gone away from the tomb a little bit. Then it's to the women; it's not just to Mary. So you do have sort of several different mentions of the appearance at different timelines and. And, you know, different ways to kind of deal with that. I mean, one way is to, again, use the different texts as if they're all trying to narrate the events in the same way for the same purposes and kind of piece it together. So that's one possibility. You could have the appearance to Mary right away individually. The other women had perhaps left, and then he appears to all of them later on, and Luke doesn't mention that. That's one way to kind of piece that together. Again, I'd suggest that in each case, you know, and again, it's not that they're contradictory, but the reason they describe the events the way they do, each evangelist, is because they have a different goal or purpose in mind. So in Luke, for example, he very frequently talks about revelation of Jesus appearing in meals. So you have this in Acts, and especially in his feeding of the 5,000. You have this also in his revealing in the breaking of the bread with the disciples on the road to Emmaus. So it kind of fits other themes in Luke of Jesus revealing himself in fellowship in a meal, which I think without difficulty we can identify as the Lord's Supper. So there's a theological purpose to indicating Jesus' revelation rather than a historical, you might say. With John, you have similarly, again, I mentioned before, this focus on individual characters. So it's entirely in keeping with how John describes Jesus interacting with people, that it's an individual that he appears to, and that it's Mary. So, again, I think if we keep in line with the purposes of the evangelists and what they're doing throughout their narratives, throughout the Gospels, these sorts of questions are more easily dealt with.
Here, Mark is of particular interest because depending on how far you want to read past a certain verse in the last chapter of Mark, and there are legitimate questions there, although we got another question on that I'll get to in just a moment. Mark, just the bare-bones short reading of Mark, has the women coming, finding an empty tomb, and simply walking away afraid. And they're
actually running away terrified.
Yes, and they don't even see a risen Christ, according to Mark's gospel. What is Mark writing for, and why? How would you explain that, if we read it that way, that rather abrupt and kind of disturbing ending?
Sure. Now, yeah, there's a couple ways. I mean, I happen to think that the gospel ends here in keeping with how Mark narrates his gospel elsewhere. And the key phrase here is actually in verse 7. And you notice there, you know, go say to his disciples and to Peter, keep in mind, who had denied him three times, that he goes before you into Galilee, and there you will see him. And the key phrase is actually, just as he said to you. And what you have going on in Mark's gospel, especially when Jesus begins his entrance into Jerusalem, is Jesus constantly saying to people, go do this, or this will happen. So you're going to find a donkey over here. You're going to deny me three times. I'm going to be handed over to the rulers and the chief priests, and they're going to kill me, and on the third day rise. So all these things that Jesus says comes true. They happen. When other people talk, like Peter, I will never deny you, right? Or we will never flee. Everything a human character says, a human person in the gospel says, doesn't happen. And so you have this contrast between Jesus' faithfulness and people's unfaithfulness. And so where the Gospel of Mark leaves you is with the promise of Jesus that you will see him in Galilee, that this is a certainty. And so for those who Mark is writing for, probably persecuted Christians, because he more than any other gospel references persecutions, that you will undergo persecutions, that yeah, this is going to be difficult. Yeah, you will fail. Yeah, you will make promises and maybe not be able to keep them. But your faith and your salvation is not dependent on you. It is certain because Jesus Christ has risen from the dead, and that you can trust. And so Mark leaves you. It sounds like it's sort of a scary ending, but I think he intentionally leaves you with this little bit of fright, so you have to think about where to find certainty. Because even the women fail, who throughout the Gospel of Mark actually do things pretty well. Even the women fail at the end, but only one person does not, and that's the person of Jesus. And so that's where you find your confidence and your salvation. So I think there's actually a narrative purpose to the way Mark, if you read the ending at Mark 16, verse 8, to end it there. Now, keep in mind, the fact that Mark's Gospel was written indicates that the women actually did go back and tell. You know, I mean, somebody heard about it and somebody wrote it down. So it obviously happened, even if in the narrative itself, it's not described. And Mark actually does it several times. He mentions Pentecost, which isn't described. He mentions the temptation, which isn't described in great detail like it is in the others. So Mark tends to allude to things without explicitly laying them out. And I think that's what he's doing here.
Now, in connection with that, Mark 16, verse 8, there is a it is often contrasted with Matthew 28:8, where the women are told they run from the tomb and spread the word to the disciples. They go immediately tell the disciples, whereas Mark says they said nothing to anyone for they were afraid.
Yeah, and again, here I think the Greek is a little bit helpful because the verb tense there is an imperfect tense. So it's a as they're going, sort of a durative idea. And it's not like they never said anything ever for the rest of their lives. So I think if we're...
They didn't stop along the way to talk about it with their neighbors.
Right. They took off running, and as they're running, they don't say anything. But again, at some point, they obviously did because the gospel got written down. So Mark is leaving you with this uncertainty for a reason, and the uncertainty is specifically tied to they're just running away frightened at that moment. But clearly, at some point, they reconsidered and must have told somebody, which is what Matthew then emphasizes rather than the way Mark ends his gospel, because Matthew has a different focus. So I think it is rather easily reconcilable if we don't get too hung up on the way some of these are, you know, verb tenses are translated. I think it resolves some of those issues.
The Galilee connection. Both Matthew and Mark seem to say, well, you're going to see him in Galilee, which geographically is quite distant from the empty tomb, whereas John and Luke both have Jesus pop, well, all the Gospels eventually, have Jesus popping
Jerusalem,
up in Jerusalem. What's going on?
Well, Jesus is in his glorified, resurrected body, so he gets to do stuff that we don't get to do yet, apparently. Although the reference to Galilee, I'm glad you brought that up, because all the Synoptic Gospels follow the same basic structure, where Jesus begins his ministry in Galilee, And his ministry is quite successful. He feeds large crowds of people. He performs many miracles. He's well regarded by the people of Galilee. He teaches his disciples on the way down to Jerusalem. Then is the second section. All three of the synoptics do this. There's this sort of teaching discipleship message in the middle. But when you get to Jerusalem, Jerusalem is kind of ironically the place of all the enemies of Jesus. And he mentions this from its Old Testament background. You know, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets, you know, those sent to you. So really nothing good happens in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, kind of contrary to what you would expect, all the enemies of Jesus live and all the rejection of his ministry happens. And so when Jesus says, go back to Galilee, it's almost a hearkening back to, hey, let's go back to the place where the kingdom of God was manifest and the blind were able to see, the dead were raised, the lame made to walk, the deaf had their ears opened, all these signs of the coming of the kingdom, all that was happening in Galilee. So I think what the evangelists are doing, or what Jesus is doing, is pointing back to not only location, but also a reminder that the reign of God is out beyond Jerusalem, and especially this is prominent in Matthew, and then also in Acts, of course, beyond Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and indeed to the ends of the earth.
Okay, let's take a break right there. When we come back, I want to ask one more question on the Galilee connection, and then we'll talk about some questions that our listeners have for Dr. Jeff Kloa on apparent contradictions in the Bible today, the resurrection of Christ. Dr. Jeff Kloa is Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. But I'm glad we talk. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Augsburg Lutheran, Shawnee, Kansas. Peace Lutheran, Fresno, California. Trinity Lutheran, Casper, Wyoming. Memorial Lutheran, Houston, Texas. Trinity Lutheran, Gillette, Wyoming. Our Savior Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California. St. Mary's Lutheran, Des Moines, Iowa. Redeemer Lutheran, Caucabeca Falls, Ontario, Canada. St. Jacoby Lutheran, Shawano, Wisconsin. And St. John's Lutheran, North Prairie, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you ever wanted to know about the origins of Issues Etc.? Did you know church leaders were opposed to teaching the laity Reformation theology? Check out our new YouTube video, You Can't Teach Lay People Theology, issuesetc.org, and click support. Equipping the priesthood of all believers. Watch the short YouTube video, You Can't Teach Lay People Theology Today. Just go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org.
Hi, this is Kate in Japan, and I'm commenting on the program you had about the Unification Church.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
The most important point is to say I love your show and thank you for doing what you do. Bye from Japan.
Old theology, new technology. Issues, etc. Worldwide. Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. Issues, etc. Issuesetc.org.
Can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down.
Welcome back. We're talking about apparent contradictions in the various accounts of the resurrection of Christ, part of our Apparent Contradictions in the Bible series. Dr. Jeff Kloa is our guest. Still time for your questions or comments about these apparent contradictions in the resurrection account. 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-MY-IE. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. One more question about the Galilee apparent contradiction there. Maybe I'm misreading John, but it appears as though John's the only guy who actually delivers on the Galilee appearance. He's the guy who actually tells us late in his gospel about Jesus doing exactly what he said he would do, or what he told through the angels he would do.
Right. Well, yeah, and again, it's a revelatory event in the Gospel of John, so it fits with his way of doing things. In other words, he has a reason to actually have Jesus show up there, and then describe that event. Whereas for the other evangelists, they have other things they want to get the reader to, so they don't mention the event. So you know, it's sort of like. I mean, this is a common analogy where you have one event described by several people, and it's always going to be described from one perspective. Things will be called to mind that another person doesn't remember. We'll emphasize one thing because it's important to me, or you know, I think we need to recognize that in his wisdom, the Spirit allowed these authors to emphasize what they thought needed emphasizing for their congregations, for their people, to understand and believe the good news of Jesus' resurrection, and let them do their work. Let the Spirit do his work through these texts. So, yeah, I mean, it's there's again, it fits with the theme of different purposes, I think, in those cases. So it does correspond in that sense. You're right.
Even more perplexing is that Luke appears to just fast forward from
Emmaus. He jumps
right. Over 40 days and gets straight to you would think he's talking about an ascension that takes place outside Jerusalem, where the other Gospels tell us where the actual locale is.
Right. Right. Well, and then you have the additional problem of almost two resurrection or two ascension accounts, one in Acts and one in Luke, which don't exactly perfectly line up. You know, if the same author is in different writings narrating the same event in a couple of different ways, it shouldn't be surprising if four different writers will pick up on different themes and do it that way. And just to clarify, it's not 40 days, isn't it? The next day or the same night that he appears to the disciples at Emmaus. And then makes the leap.
Yeah,
is that what you're talking about?
Yeah,
right,
he just makes
right.
the leap straight to
makes
the ascension.
Leap straight to the straight to the ascension, right?
Bill in Illinois says this via Facebook. He says, "Here's one: Mark 16:12-13 seemed to be mirroring Luke 24, the Emmaus disciples, but in Luke, when the two reach the apostles are already confessing the resurrection and an appearance to Simon. In Mark, Jesus rebukes them for not believing this witness or his witness. Please do not take the out that the ending of Mark 16 is not canonical, especially given its prominence in the Lutheran confessions." Your thoughts?
Well, there's kind of two questions there. One is, was verses 9 through 20 part of the Gospel of Mark as it left Mark's pen, you might say? And second, what is the relation of Mark 16:12-13 to Luke 24? I guess I'll take the second one first, although I'm going to assume the first one. The comment is exactly right. It is very similar to, and I would argue based on Luke 24. What you have, and I'll just lay my hand out on the table here. What I think happened with the ending of Mark was that once you started laying the Gospels side by side, as we're kind of doing here, as was being done already at the end of the first century, they're gathering the Gospels together canonically. Opponents of Christianity are pointing out discrepancies. Celsus is the primary one who wrote an entire book against the Christians. And so the early church began to notice or recognize that this was getting to be a problem. And one of the resolutions was to rewrite the narrative, make a harmony of the Gospels. Justin Martyr did one in 160. Tatian did one in 180. And they did kind of what we're doing here, is piece it together in different ways with different levels of skills. Another way they did it was to take some of the wording from one Gospel and actually physically write it into another Gospel so that you had the wording match up even better than it already did in many cases. And I think that's what happened with the ending of Mark, that it's so abrupt and so difficult that it kind of couldn't stand by itself. And so what someone, I think well-intentioned, did was take the other Gospel accounts in Acts and write little summaries of the events to kind of finish the narrative. So if you notice verses 9 through 11, it's Jesus appearing to Mary based on John 20, and it's referencing from whom he had cast out seven demons. Well, that takes place in Luke, not in Mark. He appeared first to Mary. Well, that matches John, but it doesn't match what he just said in the first part of Mark 16. Mark 16, 12 through 13 is a summary of Luke 24. Then you get to 14 and verse 14, and it's the upper room. You've got that in Luke. You've got that in John. Verse 15, you've got the Great Commission from Matthew and from Acts. In verse 16, you've got Peter's sermon in Acts on Pentecost. In verse 17, you've got signs, casting out demons done by the apostles in the book of Acts, picking up snakes. You've got that with Paul in Malta in the book of Acts. The drinking poison you don't have, so that's kind of new. But then you go back to verse 19, and you have sitting at the right hand of God, the ascension. So you got Luke Acts there. And then going out preaching everywhere. So a kind of an overall summary. So you have actually nothing in verses 9 through 20 that isn't somewhere else in the canonical text. And I think it is intentionally written as an epitome of other texts. And I think that helps account for the difference in Mark 16, 12 to 13. If you look at the rest of the ending of Mark there, in 9 through 20, you see this phrase, they did not believe. They did not believe. So you see it in verse 11. You see it in verse 13. And then Jesus finally shows up when the 11 are reclining, and he rebukes them for not believing those who had appeared, or to whom he had appeared. So what this theme of not believing is intentional on the part of the person who wrote the longer ending, and he's imported it into the story from Luke to match whatever his interest was. I think his interest is actually much more, actually not a bad interest. In the first century, second century, if you want to prove that something actually happened, you call upon eyewitnesses. So you can't charge somebody with a crime unless you have two or three eyewitnesses. When Paul, in 1 Corinthians 15, talks about the resurrection, he invokes the eyewitnesses. And so I think what this writer is doing is he's invoking the eyewitnesses from the other Gospels and how the people in the Gospels should have believed, and finally Jesus rebukes them for not believing. So we should take these people at their word and believe their message. So I think there's just a different literary goal on the part of the longer ending than that found in Luke, and that would account for the difference.
Finally then, Dr. Kloa, should we be concerned about these apparent contradictions in the resurrection account?
Yeah, I'm glad you ended with a positive there. I took a look at Dr. Arndt's commentary on Luke, which he wrote some 20 years after the Bible difficulties or contradictions volumes. And it's a more scholarly, for pastors kind of a thing. But if I could just read a sentence, I think this is good.
Yeah, we've got about a minute here to close.
Yeah, so let me read what he says in his commentary. With feelings of grateful joy and holy triumph, a Christian peruses this chapter telling about the risen Christ and giving assurance that the death of Jesus had not been suffered in vain and that the beneficent purposes of God had been accomplished. As is well known, there are harmonization difficulties. Every one of the four Gospels has its own way of relating the Easter story. The existence of the marked differences between the narratives cannot be denied, but they do not constitute irreconcilable discrepancies. And I like the way Arndt proceeds because he wants to make sure we understand the point of the resurrection story. And this is really what the Apostle Paul lays out for us in 1 Corinthians 15, that Christ has been raised, the first fruits of the new creation, and because Christ has been raised, we who have been buried with him in baptism will rise to the same new life on the last day at his glorious return. And we can be absolutely confident of this because Jesus has returned, and people actually saw this with their own eyes. He talked with them. He ate fish with them. This is not some kind of ghost walking around or some dream walking around. It actually happened, and the people in the early church knew people who saw Jesus risen from the dead and were so confident of this that they preached this good news everywhere, and we still preach the same good news today. So that's our hope.
Dr. Jeff Kloa is Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you, Ted.
Folks, most churches are putting together their budgets right now for next year. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your church's budget, your mission budget, or advertising budget, and become part of the Issues Etc. 300. Find out more at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support, and you'll find out everything you need to know with a one-page downloadable and printable flyer for you and your congregation. The Issues Etc. 300. Really, to my mind, far from being the mark of contradiction, I think these discrepancies, apparent discrepancies, are pretty good evidence of the authenticity of these witnesses' accounts. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.